If you look at the history pattern, you will see that up to 96, Uzbekistan was the best performer in the former Soviet Union, including the Baltics, and then situation slightly changed. But at the same time, the numerous organizations like World Bank and IMF were suggesting that Uzbekistan has to reform, especially the foreign currency exchanges and also other aspects with regard to privatization especially. But Uzbekistan stayed firm, following its own Uzbek model of economy, and at the same time, so reaching levels of economic growth and puzzling all the experts and academics. And that's why Uzbekistan remains as a very exciting region to study economics and to study why all these kind of economic patterns and economic actually laws do not really work exactly the way they work in other parts of the world. And in order to do that, we have two brilliant speakers with us who are very knowledgeable. You should make use of the chance and ask them questions. We would like to zoom in and talk about mostly about labor relations. First, like land labor relations will be voiced by Nodir Janibekov, who is at YAMO, Leibniz Institute for Agricultural Research and Transition Economies. That was hard to remember, but somehow I did it. And also we have the second speaker, Jahangir Kaharov, who is from Griffith University. He flew all the way from Australia, 24 hours, long flight, to be with us and to share his perspective on labor migrations and their interrelation with households in Uzbekistan. And taking into account that according to different estimates, from 3 to 5 million labor migrants from Uzbekistan are spread like mostly in Russia, and also, we have to keep in mind that there are like 17 million people who represent kind of current labor force, so it's approximately like a quarter of labor force represented in other countries, so it's an issue you cannot neglect. And having said that, I would give floor first to Nodir Janibekov. You'll have like 20 minutes, and I'll be very strict on these 20 minutes, and as I understand, this is the way to proceed with Uzbek speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
Jahangir will speak about social economic consequences of external labor migration remittances in Uzbekistan.
Well, I would like to start with the ritual of thanking the organizers for putting together this great event and for taking me out of bushes of Australia. This research actually is not topic of my PhD research. My PhD research looks at the cross-country study of remittances in the former Soviet Union and Central Eastern Europe. But GIZ and World Bank did a good survey in 2013 covering labor migration, labor outcomes, and remittances in Uzbekistan. And with some other colleagues of mine, we used the opportunity, applied for grant research funding from NUPI, Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. We were lucky enough to get the funding and did, I think, a good research, first approximation at least, looking at the social economic consequences of labor migration in Uzbekistan. As you see, there were several other people, all of them from Westminster International University in Tashkent. So our research questions. What are the economic and social consequences of migration and remittances in Uzbekistan? The objective is to create an up-to-date profile of migrants, which was a pretty much descriptive part of the research, and another part is to run economic regressions to estimate the impact of remittances on households left behind in Uzbekistan, how the remittances spent in the country. Since this survey done by GIZ and World Bank was just one-time event, a cross-sectional study of households, we had to compare it to something, and we just had data from other authors, research by other authors, which was done before, which was pretty much descriptive. So that was our point of departure in doing these comparisons, in drawing the portrait of a migrant at different periods of time. In the framework of in the research, we actually used some other data in addition to data that we were able to obtain from the survey. Well, I would like to talk about that project from which we took this data. The project is called the CatGut. It could be interesting for some of you who are doing research in the area. I think Sebastian raised the issue of reliability of data. And CatGut research project, which stands for Central Asian Data Gathering and Analysis Team, collects some alternative data for Central Asian countries. I'm covering Uzbekistan. There are some other researchers in other Central Asian countries. For instance, one of the data streams sort of that we are putting together is the PLOV index, similar to Big Mac index, which compares price of preparing PLOV in Central Asian context in different Central Asian countries. We gather data from the markets, not like Uzbek official statistics, which basically takes data from the price of ingredients, pretty much fixed, like cotton, edible oil, or eggs, or whatever, the prices which are pretty much controlled by the government. We just started that part of the project, PLOV index, in case of Uzbekistan, actually, we are doing a conversion into a foreign currency using official rates and black market rates, while for other countries of Central Asia, we are using just a unified rate. So there are different possibilities for comparisons in there. But in addition to PLOV index, we also do, we did also reports on connections between gender and politics, trade relations among Central Asian countries, investment flowing into Central Asian countries. So there were 10 projects which we accomplished already gathering data. And in this part, I'm just comparing the number of work permits issued and remittances, and we see that permanent growth in both of them, indicating that remittances are becoming a very important part of the revenues for Uzbek households. Well, a few words about theoretical literature. Well, literature on labor migration starts with studies of Adam Smith, the classic of economic science, and he basically looks at the demand and supply for labor, and he argues that depending if there is an oversupply of labor, labor migrates from one territory to another territory. Very simple analysis. Harris and Todaro develop that theory a bit further, and they argue that it's not only income which matters, supply and demand which matters, but also expected income of households which matters, and that's why people migrate. New economics of migration developed by Massey argues that it's not individual decision, and Adam Smith, Harris, and Todaro were looking at it as an individual decision, whereas Massey says that it is a household decision. Households decide together whether a household representative should migrate to foreign country and earn additional income for their home or not. Dual labor market theory developed by Piore in 1960s, also interesting look at the migration theory. They look at the developed markets, developed countries with developed market systems, and assert that labor markets in Western countries are segmented. There are two parts of it, primary and secondary markets. Primary markets are so-called 3D market, dangerous, dirty, demeaning jobs, and secondary markets are the markets with better career opportunities where more qualified, skilled people work. So as economy matures, people from locals, let's say, of developed economies from primary markets migrate to secondary market with better career prospects. And those niches which are empty, which become empty in the primary market, are filled with migrants from other countries who are agreed to do these 3D jobs. Well, actual research testing this hypothesis of existence of a dual labor market actually doesn't prove that there is this clear segmentation of the market, but this is what Piori came up at that time when econometric science was not that much developed, I suppose. Network theory has, very good significance for what's happening with the migration right now from Uzbekistan to Russia, for instance. According to this theory, labor markets, labor migration starts in a modest level usually, but slowly the networks in the labor market in the diaspora in foreign country build up, and then these diasporas gain critical mass and start attracting people even when there is no much need for labor migration. So they're becoming sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The theory of cumulative causation developed by Myrdal and then Massey later on tries to combine all the elements of the theories which were developed before. And the last one, NELM, New Economics of Labor Migration, developed by Stark, starting in 1980s. Add a few other dimensions at the phenomenon of labor migration at in explaining why migration happens. According to them, labor migration, it's not only a household decision. It is also related to the level of development of capital markets in developing countries. Families send their representatives to foreign countries not only because of the expected income, but also because they want to insure themselves. They look at the phenomenon of labor migration in African countries and find that in case of Mozambique and Ethiopia, in many cases, people send, households send their representatives to foreign countries, even though they had a decent income in their own country, just in order to diversify against unexpected shortfalls in income of the family. That was a kind of a very important new element added to the development of economics of labor migration. As to empirical literature, empirical research on Central Asian countries is very limited and usually based on very small sample surveys. Atamonov and Vandenberg did interesting research according to their findings. Remittances in Kyrgyzstan mainly dominated, at least in case of Russia, by big size of transactions. 80-90% of the volume of transactions are accounted by large size transactions which don't look like labor remittances. We are talking about amounts exceeding $5,000, which is not a typical amount for a labor migrant to send from Russia to Kyrgyzstan. So probably some of the data which is captured by the data on remittances from Russian Central Bank captures this trade-related transaction instead of labor remittances. But at the same time, some other research with similar surveys actually with similar respondents in other countries indicate that in case of Azerbaijan, in case of Tajikistan, this phenomenon does not exist. I mean, in their balance of trade transactions, remittances are reported in usual size, usually small scale transactions dominate in remittances data. And then another additional shortcoming of the empirical research in Central Asia on impact of remittances, they tend to focus mainly on determinants of migrations, migration and remittances, whereas in our research we emphasize the consequences of remittances. So data for remittance research could come came in case of in our study from this survey done in 2013 by World Bank and GIZ, covering 8,620 individuals and 1,500 households, which is a good size. And actually, a similar research was done in some other Central Asian countries, in Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, so there is a possibility for comparative research in future. Since it's a relatively recent survey, nobody has done this yet, especially taking into account the fact that it was very difficult to obtain this survey data in case of Uzbekistan. It took us half a year to obtain the results of survey. That's why we didn't have a lot of time to elaborate, to do our estimations within the framework of our research. And that's why our findings, which I will show later, are not so robust, but at least they're indicating which expenditures are the main items for households of labor migrants. We also used some data from the Central Bank of Russia, which is available publicly. It is available in different structures, in different viewpoints. Data collected for remittances via MTOs, money transfer operators, data collected for transfers of individuals, so different views on remittances data. That's a portrait of Uzbek migrant. According to our research, about 30% of them bring their spouses, which wasn't the case according to research of other people, other scholars. In the past, most of the people, labor migrants, would travel alone. Another trend, a relatively recent trend, most of the migrants now pursue long-term migration policy. The length of stay of migrants, the average length of stay of migrants in Russia, in our case, most of the migration goes to Russia, has increased. It was 4 to 6 months before, in 2006, 2007, but according to 2013 data, they are now staying on average 8 months. 49% admit that they speak Russian poorly, and 8% say that they don't speak Russian at all. And this is a self-assessment of migrants. So I don't know, probably it's could be overestimation as well. So the language skills are not there, but this is not a hurdle for the labor migrants. Most of the migrants come from large families in rural areas of Uzbekistan. And have a secondary general special education. Not too many people with higher education, of course. And basically, in case of Uzbekistan, we are not talking about brain drain, but we are talking about exports of unskilled labor in many cases. Well, this is econometric part of it. What we tried to do is to estimate the impact of remittances. By outcome here, we mean expenditures. As I show in a minute, we are talking about different types of different items of expenditure, healthcare, education, food, non-food items. On the right-hand side of the equation, we have the main variable of interest for us, remittances, and the host of other factors which are deemed to be relevant for estimation of the impact of remittances on the household expenditures. I know that this is probably not the most exciting part of the research, so let's skip that part. To explain interpretation of our research, we need to give a little bit of a background of the strategy of doing econometric research. Yeah, I'll try to do it within 5 minutes. The thing is, there are special courses to explain the whole thing, and it's very difficult to do it. Yeah. Okay, all right. The main problem here in our example, for instance, remittances have impact on the outcome variable on expenditures. We are looking at the impact, but there are many other factors which are impacting the expenditures, right? The most important thing is that remittances may impact expenditures, and expenditures could also impact remittances, right? People sending their households, as I explained, because they don't have enough income in some cases, right? So in some cases, the outcome variable impacts remittances, and the remittances impact the outcome variable. So there is a problem with reverse causality. If you want to estimate the impact of remittances, pure impact of remittances, we have to take this into account, the existence of a reverse causality here. There are also other things which impact remittances. Outcome variable, expenditures. The way people were brought up, for instance, the pattern of how they spend money, right? They're receiving income from foreign countries, right? Remittances, this is like a windfall. And the spending pattern could be dependent on how they brought up sometimes, right? And that variable, very difficult to estimate. And it's not in the survey data. There is no proxy for it. And that's called omitted variable. So there are a few things with econometric models which interrupt a correct interpretation of the variables. And that should be taken into account when we are doing instrumental variable estimations. And I'm not going to spend on this a lot of time because it becomes too complicated now. There is one thing which I wanted to say also. Error term in econometric models is something where econometricians put everything which they cannot explain. It's kind of a garbage bin. So all the other variables tend to be interpreted, but the error term where you put what you don't need. So we did this. We came up with instrumental variable, and it was a distance. The trick with coming up with instrumental variable is that it should be related to independent variable of main interest, which is remittances, but should not be remitted to the outcome variable, which is expenditure in our case. And we found that distance is directly related to remittances because people have to travel in order to earn money and send remittances, right? But it's not directly related to expenditures. Then we did our regressions. This way, we are overcoming those problems that I mentioned, reverse causality, omitted variable bias, and simultaneity. So all these regressions, I don't know if anyone is familiar with the format of presenting econometric research data results, but what it says here, I'll try to put it in simple terms. Total expenditures, this is not our main variable of interest, have very significant and strong impact on expenditure items. Health, education, non-food and food expenditures. 3 stars in all these indicators indicate that they're very statistically significant. 3 stars means that we have only 1% doubt about the significance of the results. Remittances, according to OLS, OLS is the name of the technique, order and least squares, doesn't have any statistically significant impact, and it's very small. This is what we did with the very simple method, order and least squares. And in the next stage, we did two-stage least squares, instrumental variable regressions. And here we have different results now. You see remittances suddenly become significant. Impact of remittances on expenditures in 2 cases is significant, which means that in Uzbekistan, households which sent migrants to foreign countries, to Russia, spent their income mostly on non-food expenditures and the health. But expenditures for food is actually going down. People getting remittances, their income is increasing, but instead of spending more on food, they're spending less on food. Whereas education, education is not, it does not seem to be a very important element of household expenditure. Rise in remittances, increase in remittances does not result in higher education spending. Why is that? Well, we have our own interpretation of the situation. Probably people who migrate from Uzbekistan, most of them at least live in rural areas. So they probably have some farm business, or they cultivate their own crops in small scale, right? So when they receive remittances, they probably invest in some additional facilities, farmland. And then they increase production of food for themselves. So that's why they probably decrease the amount of food expenditures. Actually, this is part of the conclusion, right? And that's why, actually, we need to look at additionally at this data and look at how entrepreneurship impacts remittances. And that would be another part of the research. And we are applying for another research grant to do that research. So if you invite me for another conference next time, we'll talk about the results of the other research. So this is what I just discussed, basically. Health expenditures seem to be the most important part, the most severely impacted by increasing remittances. Significance level is very high. We have little doubt about the strength of those results. We also did some other estimations, which I am not going to talk about. They didn't come out very robust anyway. And the policy implications, the first one is the most important one. According to our findings, the impact of migration on the left behind is very complex. It's not very straightforward. Remittances received, expenditures increased. Some expenditures increased, but others not. And to understand everything, to have a full picture of it, several series of studies need to be undertaken. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jahangir. Actually, Nader was kind enough to donate part of his time to Jahangir, and I think he actually should be thankful to Nader. That was a very interesting presentation, and I would open up the floor for all questions and comments and the suggestions. So David goes first.
Yes, David Abramson from the State Department. I'm just wondering if you could extrapolate from your research findings to help explain, understand Uzbeks' ability to withstand drops in remittances over the last year to the extent that they have dropped. Also, to help explain sort of a mentality of being ability to defer to how do I want to put it? Put off decision makings about migration. Are they thinking about weathering this because their level of optimism? How do you assess that based on your findings? Are they likely to just to try to weather it for a year, hoping that the economy will change? Or at what point will they start to change their strategy and approach to labor migration?
Yeah. Well, actually, there was a part of my interpretation which I skipped because I didn't have enough time for that. And that's, I think, related to that. And the data collected, the survey data collected by GIZ and the World Bank is very rich. There is a model of questions on savings, actually, and on bank accounts as well. And actually, I was hypothesizing that expenditures are not growing that big. I mean, maximum increase was 10% for education, not for health expenditures, right? Because part of it is going to savings, I suppose, and people adjust their saving for rainy day. That's because they are not confident about the future of money stream from remittances, and that's way of insuring against these downfalls in remittances, I suppose. And again, as I said, this is hypothesis which need to be tested by running these boring econometric models. But this is the only way to check it if it's really so, you know.
Thank you. Will?
Will O'Rourke, I'm just an independent scholar. I had a quick question about definition of household size. In terms of, first of all, how do you define that? And second of all, did you find anywhere in your analysis about pooling of resources in the diaspora?
Diaspora in Russia.
Yeah. In Russia, more or less, yeah.
Yeah. Well, household size is taken in the survey as it is. I mean, it was a random selection of households. No matter how many people are in the household, it could be 7, 8, 4, 3, 2, 1. It's a random selection. And when you do random selection, it's more representative of the country, especially if you increase the size of the sample. And that's why they didn't do any restrictions in terms of household size. And what was the second question?
More or less, maybe the informal kind of networks that are formed within
the structures. It's difficult to say because the survey didn't cover Russian part of the equation, you know. It was looking at the Uzbekistan labor market mainly.
Navbahor.
Thank you so much. Fascinating. I actually find your boring theory is very interesting because that's not something that we look at and consider, you know, very often. You mentioned new economics of migration. How is that being regulated in Uzbekistan, in your view? And you may not have done any research on this, but I'm just interested in your insights. My question to Farooq, to Nader, sorry, very quickly, is to what extent has labor migration actually changed the agriculture sector in Uzbekistan? We know that a lot of migrant workers are from rural places, but that's just a general observation, you know, easy to say. But to what extent we're seeing the changes, the effects?
Now, Bahor never asks easy questions.
Would you like to start?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for the question. And, yeah, I mean, basically what in the key informant surveys, for instance, talking to local administration or the former collective farm managers or to people who work also in archives and kind of mahalla leaders and also to households, you see there is kind of a significant effect from two sides. Yeah, first is that a lot of people left agricultural sector to non-agricultural sector in Russia or Kazakhstan, construction, and this there is a loss of skills, yeah? There is the knowledge was not transferred. People are not interested in agriculture. They're interested in construction sector. Another side, remittances, which were directly transferred to rural households, they're in some way used for also partly in agriculture, buying pesticides, repairing existing machine, whatever machinery they have. So there is two sides, and it's very difficult to say which is dominating, yeah? Very complicated. I mean, it's part of another study to look if there is a positive effect on people being not less interested in agriculture and at the same time remittances to those used by those who stayed in agriculture. Thank you.
Well, should I answer the first part of the question? New economics of labor migration is a theory which is based basically on two main principles. One is that yes, people who migrate are those who are deprived who don't have enough income. But it's not absolute deprivation that that is the motive of migration, but the relative deprivation. I mean, the fact that poor people migrate is kind of obvious. Adam Smith was talking about that. And the addition that they did was that migrants or potential migrants compare not with other people, but with their reference group. Let's say that there is a group of scientists, and some people in this group think that they are deprived more than others, so they decide to migrate. And then another motive, as I mentioned in my presentation, is inclusion of the insurance motive. Households decide on migration based on the necessity to insure against shortfalls in household income. So that's why probably Uzbekistan's case does not fit into this theory very well, but in case of Mexico, migrants in many cases are not the most poor ones. This is what Nelm says. Regarding the policies of Uzbekistan's authorities on labor migration, it would be better if they didn't have any policy. Policy at the moment is aimed at discriminating against them. There is a kind of condescending approach to them, or condemning sometimes, hatred in some cases. Everyone understands that labor migration from Uzbekistan is in many cases unskilled, unqualified labor, but our research indicates that they contribute a lot to relieving, for instance, budget constraints of the people. So they fulfill the role of safety network for a huge chunk of the population.
Thank you. Marina, then Bakhtiyor.
My name is Marina. Actually, I have two questions, one for Jahangir and another one for Nader. Jahangir, maybe I missed something in the beginning of your presentation, but you mentioned that you did the research across whole Uzbekistan, and I would like to know what was the share of households and individuals that you asked in rural and urban areas, so mm-hmm. maybe the percentage if you can give. And have you noticed in your research the differences in responses? For example, maybe people remit more or for longer time to rural areas rather than urban areas. So I'm interested in those mm-hmm. differences between urban and rural areas. And also, what was your section across the regions of Uzbekistan, and whether mm-hmm. you found any differences in patterns mm-hmm. In expenditures maybe across the regions of Uzbekistan? That's mm-hmm. what I'm interested in. And my second question goes to Nader. I'm not sure whether you're familiar about it, or maybe you faced it in the course during your studies or research. You mentioned several times in your presentation the land degradation. So I'm interested whether this land degradation or other environmental factors influence agriculture patterns in Uzbekistan, and if yes, then how, and whether some of these land degradation issues actually force people to migrate to urban areas in Uzbekistan. So if you're knowledgeable. Thank you.
Jahangir, this time for you to go okay. first, I think.
Well, I myself didn't collect any data for this research. GIZ and World Bank did, and they did actually a very good job. I do not remember how they sampled it, but they did it exactly so that it would be representative of the whole country. So let's say if 40% of Uzbekistan live in urban areas, they took 40% of the households from urban areas. 60% live in rural areas, and then they took 60% from rural areas.
Can I briefly jump in into that? Mm-hmm. Actually, we collected this data for GIZ, and the way we actually structured that based on population in the region. So, like, we gave, like, based on the population percentage of households we have to interview, and then did it randomly.
What was the other part of the question? We didn't look at it. It's a good point. It's a good possible research for another grant. So we can discuss this. Yeah. It's better to do it by one, so that you have more grants. You know.
You don't want to cooperate.
No, we can cooperate, but one grant at a time, you know, for one area of research.
Concerning land degradation, I mean, this history of 25 years, probably it's very difficult to say what is the impact of. So there should be a click point when the land degradation tries to affect the decision of producer either to leave the land or kind of migrate. Yeah, it's even heavier to leave the rural dwelling, whatever, and move to the and basically closer city to earn some income, for instance, by working as a taxi driver. So I think it's from what I understood from the interviews, and I didn't look at this directly, but at land degradation, we have two players, yeah, crucial players. It's farmers who make the decision whether to use this land or not, and then the government or officials, which also influence why the delivery targets, cotton production or wheat production targets, whether the farmers actually operate this degraded land or leaves it abandoned or cultivated with some nitrogen-fixing crop, or I don't know. So from there is different stories, so it's very difficult to observe the pattern is actually whether actually farmers are leaving the degraded land as in a classical sense. Yeah, land degraded because of monotonous, for instance, cotton production or bad practices. There is a lot of land degraded what farmers report because infrastructure, irrigated infrastructure been in bad, poor conditions. So tail end farmers located in the bottom of the irrigation canal, they claim that the land is degrading because they don't receive enough water to leach their salt from the soil or irrigate properly, level. So they don't have incentives also to level land properly. So it's very difficult question. I think it requires some additional direct questions rather than personal observations to see whether farmers consider land degradation as a big problem to actually abandon the field and divert to something else, yeah, to other activities. Sorry.
Bakhtiar was waiting for the question. Well, we should give him floor. Otherwise, he would think there is some kind of Uzbek conspiracy against the Tajiks.
No, I won't. Believe me. Bakhtiar Safarov, Central Asian Consulting. I have a question for Jahangir. It's a great presentation. I have a question regarding the partial purchase parity on your pillow index. Uh-huh. I think it's a great idea. Do you think, you know, to expand this index to some, you know, more to other Central Asian countries? And
actually, we are doing that. I mean, we have so-called NUPI fellows or Katgat fellows, Central Asia Data Gathering and Analysis Team fellows in Tajikistan. I don't know if you know Kahor Aminov. He's working on that. He left, actually. He's now with Islamic Development Bank, but he's still collecting data for that. And then we have a representative in Turkmenistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan as well, I mean, Kazakhstan as well. We just started last year, so it would be very interesting to look at it when it becomes a kind of series of data. We are doing it on quarterly basis. And it is the picture that we are getting right now is very interesting. CPI in Uzbekistan, for instance, is grossly underestimated. I mean, the inflation level, which conveyed by CPI index, is very low, some like, what, 7-8% or something like that. But according to our data, we have more interesting results. To use it for your research, I mean, to do econometric models again, we need series of data. That will come once we do it for several years. But yeah, we have all representatives in all of the Central Asian countries, to put it shortly.
Marlene?
Yeah.
I have two questions, one for the two of you and one only for Jahangir. I was wondering, do we see any differences in pattern of remittances between those who are sending remittances from Russia and those who are sending remittances from Kazakhstan? Mm-hmm. Because Uzbek migrants in Kazakhstan are statistically more in the agricultural field than those who are in Russia. So I wonder if we have any kind of comparison between what is sent from Russia, what is sent from Kazakhstan. Do we make more money when we are in Russia than in Kazakhstan? I don't know. These kind of things. And a question for the two of you, following a little bit what Marina was saying. When we look at what we know about remittances and agriculture, both in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, we have very regionalized knowledge. We know the situation in Batken region is very different from the situation in around Bishkek. We know that Pamir is very different from the other region in Tajikistan. We know which region are sending migrants, and we can connect that more to the agricultural situation. And when we are discussing Uzbekistan, I feel sometimes we just look at like if, at just one unified country, but we don't have information at the regional level. And I wanted the two of you on your own topics, if you could try to have a kind of, give us a kind of picture of what do we know. I mean, either situation with land more difficult in Surkhandarya, Kashkadarya than in the Fergana, as we could imagine, who is sending more migrants from which region. I mean, what do we know if we try to look at the big regions and not at the country as a kind of unifying block?
I think Farouk can answer that question, the second one, because this, they are they collect data for that, right? Which regions are sending more migrants. So go ahead.
Well, I don't remember on the top of my mind because I haven't analyzed data yet, but we did collect, and we have like all the pattern of data which we actually discussed, taking into like savings and everything by region. So we can look at it, this closely, but on the top of my mind, I just don't remember.
Well, answering the question regarding Kazakhstan, well, remittance patterns from Kazakhstan to Uzbekistan is very different from remittance patterns from Russia to Uzbekistan. Actually, there was another research on this. The thing is, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan obviously have common borders, but Russia and Uzbekistan, they don't have borders. In order to get to Uzbekistan from Russia, you have to cross a fifth or sixth largest country in the world. So it's not an easy task. Besides that, sending money from Russia is very inexpensive, very cheap. It's a very competitive market, money transfer market. That's why it is actually preferable for migrants to send money via remittances. According to our estimations, only 20% of remittances sent by informal channels of transfer. By informal, I mean when people bring the money in their pockets, when they pass the money with their relatives or friends, or use any other informal network. So in case of Russia, it's very small. That's why data that we get from Central Bank of Russia is very reliable. You have to make adjustment for informal trade that we talked about, and for informal remittances. That's it. Well, in case of Kazakhstan, it's much more complicated. Since it's a borderline, there is a border. I'm not saying that it's easy to cross the border, but it's possible, and it's possible to bribe the custom officers. And a lot of migrants work in the areas which is very close to Kazakhstan. Official numbers for remittances is very low. It's like, I don't know, 5-10 million or something. When I was looking at it a few years ago, it was $2 million only dollars per year. But unofficially, according to another research done by Merwert from Kazakhstan, the remittances, total amount of remittances, including informal and formal, is somewhere around 500 million. So we get information from official sources about a few tens of millions, whereas officially, unofficially, it's about half a billion. And one more question that I forgot to answer, Maria's question regarding the differences in terms of remittances received by in different areas of Uzbekistan. Actually, there is some difference, and this is the problem of all the self-reported surveys. When you ask respondents to answer to questions and report about their expenditures or their income, they're not always honest. You see, and the level of honesty depends on the region as well. In In Armenia, actually, there was a research which looked at the determinants of dishonesty of households which were reporting about their remittances. And they listed basically three reasons why they are not... the research found that there were three reasons. First, they were afraid of tax authorities because they will come on knocking on their doors and asking to pay the taxes on the income that they received from abroad. Another one, they were afraid of losing subsidies, benefits they were getting from the government. And the most important one, they were afraid of their relatives and friends that would come and ask for loans, money, you know, charity, that kind of things. So there are different reasons for underreporting, and it depends on the region.
Yeah, and Marlon, answering your question about whether it's possible to kind of cover kind of on this whatever studies we're doing on depending on different contexts, yeah, infrastructure, landscape, people, and yeah, I think that's one of the problem in Central Asia, that research is very patchy. You see different groups from different disciplines who find either fascinating a certain region because of it's unique, or they like the environment, or because they're forced to work there, or they're not allowed to work in certain areas, yeah, like in Fergana, very, very sensitive. So I think it's very difficult to develop it, and what I like is it's very unique, this kind of studies, what they are doing, trying to collect the panel data or look through the, covering the entire five countries with kind of first-hand observations, three countries, yeah, still more than one. And so this is very unique, I think, what they're doing, and this is what academic community, I think, working on Central Asia is pretty much disadvantaged with our colleagues who work, for instance, on Africa and have better access to conduct surveys or also kind of even collecting the second-hand information from official statistics, just, yeah, not reliable, but still to get some picture of what is there. So this is one of the things which I think preventing to establish kind of a study which would cover the entire country or the entire region. It's patchy networks also, and perception of the officials, government, in terms of kind of this academia research.
I'm looking at this watch and it went crazy. Look at this. This is jumping. Okay, that's fine. Who is not there? We have two last questions, and one David, and then the completing one, Timur.
Thank you. One little point and then a bigger question. One is that I think according to the IOM, about 90% of labor migrants from Uzbekistan to Russia are male. So I noticed there was that statistic about 30% have spouses.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could clarify that discrepancy. And then, unless I'm missing something, huge demographic, cultural change. And then the other question is noting the Central Bank of Russia's remittance figures pointed out that in the last quarter of 2014 and for the entire year, Uzbek remittances to Uzbekistan declined a lot more than those to Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan, or maybe even double for Tajikistan. So I'm wondering if you can explain that.
Okay. Well, regarding the first question, the share of female migrants or migrants who are taking their wives, although these are different concepts, right? The World Bank GIZ research was done in 2013, and I think the research done by International Organization for Migration was done a few years back, right? And there were significant changes since then. We had the GFC in 2008, right? So if that research was done in 2009, that was the year when crisis hit the bottom, actually. So it was the year when the number of migrants went down, but still, in terms of percentages, it looks like it has been increasing very significantly. I mean, it's been 5 years since 2008, 2009, right? So probably the balance in terms of gender balance among migrants shifted to a certain degree. And, regarding the attitude to Kazakh, Kyrgyz, Tajik, and Uzbek migrants, I think it's different. Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, I think they have better relations with Russia. And I think Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan included in this organization, the regional organization. I'm not an international relations specialist. I tend to forget the names of these organizations, Eurasec or whatever, right? Or Customs Union. Yeah, I think Customs Union. They are members of the Customs Union, and Uzbekistan is not. So politically, the level of cooperation probably low. Maybe it has some impact on the number of migrants and the amount of remittances as well. It's easier probably to get legalized for Tajik and Kyrgyz migrants compared to Uzbeks. The thing is, it has certain impact. For instance, for Belarus, Russia used to have some requirements until 2010 or something, and then they dropped all the requirements. And after that, the amount of remittances from Belarus, from Russia to Belarus increased.
Thank you. And the last question?
It's a very brief question, actually, because I think you're doing a really great job. With the data collection and interpretation, and yeah, I think interpretation is the most sort of difficult task, mm-hmm. because even from your explanation, I can feel that you have a lot of conditional versions of yeah. why things are as you think they are, mm-hmm. but we are not entirely sure they are the way they are. Yeah. yeah? So I'm just wondering, in terms of disciplinary methodology, how do you approach this interpretation? Because we used to do this Asia Barometer survey, and we really had this problem when we had the data, but we were not entirely sure that our interpretation is correct, mm-hmm. and we were constantly criticized for the conditional interpretation that we were sort of giving. So I'm just wondering, what is the approach?
I think it's a very good question, and I was thinking about it myself as well. The thing is, to capture the whole magnitude of the phenomenon, you have to do, econometrics, first of all, on the whole host of outcome variables, taking remittances as an independent variable, the main independent variable. So, as I said during my presentation, there should be a series of research. First, we'll look at the expenditures, right? That's an initial step. And then some of it is going somewhere. So what are the possible channels where it's disappearing? Savings or entrepreneurship? We could look at them. And then when we have results, depending on that, we can move to the next stage. Maybe look at bank accounts, at the possibility of having bank accounts, or at the non-farm business only. If there is no impact on entrepreneurship in general. So there are different approaches, and actually based only from the data from the World Bank and GIZ, it is possible to write a book, in fact. That research that was done by Stark, who created NELM, New Economics of Labor Migration, they looked at the different migration and remittances phenomenon in different countries, but mostly focused in Africa, and then they come up with a theory. So that's why I think it should be a series of research, but depending on the outcomes of each stage of research, it could be modified.
Well, on this note, we shall conclude, and I think we all agree that this was a fascinating panel with two very interesting presentations. So please join me in thanking our two presenters, and enjoy your lunch. Thank you.